offerings of some sort.
"Welcome to Habitat Goddard," he said with a warm smile. "I'm Professor James Wilmot. Most of you have already met me, and for those of you who haven't, I look forward to meeting you and discussing our future. But for now, let's take a look at the world we'll be inhabiting for at least the next 5 years."
With that, one of the young men behind him tapped the keyboard on the wall beside the hatch, and the massive steel door swung slowly inward. Eberly felt a puff of warm air touch his face, like the light touch of his mother's faintly remembered caress. The group of 16 department leaders started through the hatch. "This is it," Eberly thought, feeling a new dread rising inside his guts. "There's no turning back now. This is the new world they want me to live in. This huge cylinder, this machine, I'm being exiled all the way out to Saturn. That's where they're sending me, as far away as they can. I'll never see Earth again." He was almost the last one in line. He heard the others oohing and aahing by the time he got to the open hatch and stepped through. Then he saw why. Stretching out in all directions around him was a green landscape shining in warm sunlight. Gently rolling grassy hills, clumps of trees, little meandering streams spread out into the hazy distance. The group was standing on an elevated knoll with a clear view of the habitat's broad interior. Bushes thick with vivid red hibiscus and pale lavender oleanders lined both sides of a curving path that led down to a group of low buildings, white and gleaming in the sunlight that streamed in through the low windows. A Mediterranean village, Eberly thought, set on the gentle slope of a grassy hill overlooking a shimmering blue lake. This is some travel brochure vision of what a perfect Mediterranean countryside would look like. Far in the distance, he made out what looked like farmlands, square little fields that appeared to be recently plowed, and more clusters of whitewashed buildings. There was no horizon. Instead, the land simply curved up and up, hills and grass and trees and more little villages with their paved roads and sparkling streams, up and up on both sides, until he was craning his neck, looking straight overhead at still more of the carefully, lovingly landscaped greenery. "It's breathtaking," Marinella whispered.
"Awesome," said one of the others.
Eberly thought, a virgin world, untouched by war or famine or hatred, untouched by human emotions of any kind, waiting to be shaped, controlled. Maybe it won't be so bad here after all. "This must have cost a bloody fortune," a young man said in a strong, matter-of-fact voice. "How could the consortium afford it?" Professor Wilmot smiled and touched his mustache with a fingertip.
"We got it in a bankruptcy sale, actually. The previous owners went broke trying to turn this into a retirement center."
"Who retires nowadays?"
"That's why they went bankrupt," Wilmot replied.
"Still, the cost."
"The International Consortium of Universities is not without resources," said Wilmot. "And we have many alumni who can be very generous when properly approached."
"You mean when you twist their arms hard enough?"
a woman joked. The others laughed. Even Wilmot smiled good-naturedly.
"Well," the professor said, "this is it. This will be your home for the next 5 years, and even longer for many of you."
"When do the others start coming up?"
"As the personnel board approves applicants and they pass their final physical and psychological tests, they will come aboard. We have about two-thirds of the available positions already filled, and more people are signing up at quite a brisk pace."
The others asked more questions, and Wilmot patiently answered them. Eberly filtered their nattering out of his conscious attention. He peered intently at the vast expanse of the habitat, savoring this moment of discovery, his arrival into a new world. 10,000 people. That's all they're going to permit to join us. But this habitat could hold 100,000 easily. 1 million, even. He thought of the squalor of his childhood days. 8, 10, 12 people to a room, and then the merciless discipline of the monastery schools and prison. 10,000 people, he mused. They will live in luxury here. They will live like kings. He smiled. No, he told himself. There will be only one king here, one master. This will be my kingdom, and everyone in it will bend to my will. Vienna, Schönbrunn Prison. More than a full year before he had ever heard of Habitat Goddard, Malcolm Eberle was abruptly released from prison after serving less than half his term for fraud and embezzlement. The rambling old Schönbrunn Palace had been turned into a prison in the aftermath of the refugee riots that had shattered much of Vienna and its surroundings. When Eberle first learned that he would serve his sentence in the Schönbrunn, he had been hopeful. At least it wasn't one of the grim state prisons where habitual criminals were held. He quickly learned that he was wrong. A prison is a prison is a prison, filled with thugs and perverts. Pain and humiliation were constant dangers, fear his constant companion. The morning had started like any other. Eberle was roused from sleep by the blast of the dawn whistle. He swung down from his top bunk and waited quietly while his three cellmates used the sink and toilet. He had become accustomed to the stench of the cell, and quite early in his incarceration had learned that complaints led only to beatings, either by the guards or by his cellmates. There was a hierarchy among the convicts. Those connected with organized crime were at the top of the prestige chain. Murderers, even those poor wretches who killed in passion, were accorded more respect than thieves or kidnappers. Mere swindlers, which was Eberle's rap, were far down the chain, doomed to perform services for their superiors whether they wanted to or not. Fortunately, Eberle maneuvered himself into a cell where the top con was a former garage mechanic from the Italian province of Calabria, who had been declared guilty of banditry, terrorism, bank robbings, and murders. Although barely literate, the Calabrian was a born organizer. He ran his section of the prison like a medieval fiefdom, settling disputes and enforcing a rough kind of justice so thoroughly that the guards allowed him to keep the peace among the prisoners in his own rough manner. When Eberle discovered that he needed a man who could operate a computer to keep him in touch with his family in their mountaintop village and the remnants of his band, still hiding in the hills, Eberle became his secretary. After that, no one was allowed to molest him. It was the mind-numbing routine of each long, dull day that made Eberle sick to his soul. Once he came under the Calabrian's protection, he got along well enough physically. But the drab sameness of the cell, the food, the stink, the stupid talk of the other convicts day after day, week after week, threatened to drive him mad. He tried to keep his mind engaged by daily visits to the prison library, where he could use the tightly monitored computer to make at least a virtual connection to the world outside. Most of the entertainment sites were censored or cut off altogether, but the prison authorities allowed, even encouraged, using the educational sites. Desperately, Eberle enrolled in one course after another, usually finishing them far sooner than expected and rushing into the next. At first, he took whatever courses came to hand. Renaissance painting, transactional psychology, municipal water recycling systematics, the poetry of Goethe. It didn't matter what the subject matter was. He needed to keep his mind occupied, needed to be out of this prison for a few hours each day, even if it was merely through the computer. Gradually, though, he found himself drawn to studies of history and politics. In time, he applied for a degree program at the Virtual University of Edinburgh. It was a great surprise when, one ordinary morning, the guard captain pulled him out of line as he and his cellmates shuffled to the cafeteria for their lukewarm breakfasts. The captain, stubble-jawed and humorless, tapped Eberle on the shoulder with his wand and said, "Follow me." Eberle was so astonished that he blurted, "Why me? What's wrong?" The captain held his wand under Eberle's nose and fingered the voltage control. "No talking in line. Now, follow me." The other convicts marched by in silence, their heads facing straight ahead but their eyes shifting toward Eberle and the captain before looking away again. Eberly remembered what the wand felt like at full charge and let his chin sink to his chest as he dutifully followed the captain away from the cabin.